and welcome to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started, all about the journey to success and professional fulfillment. There are unlikely paths to success, and then there's Steve Hindy's unlikely path to success. He was an Associated Press correspondent in the Middle East in the late 70s and early 80s, covering wars, revolutions, and the taking of the American hostages in Iran in 1979. He was also sitting not far from Anwar Sadat when Sadat was assassinated in 1981. But during those years, he also learned about home brewing from American diplomats serving in the Middle East, knowledge that would help him when he came back home, left journalism, and eventually co-founded an iconic brand, Brooklyn Brewery. Hindy is now retired and has moved from Brooklyn, New York to Brooklyn, Maine. So the question is, when you go into a restaurant or a pub there, can you get Brooklyn Lager?
No. You know, there are like 200 breweries in Maine, and they're making good beer. And there are a lot of, it really puts pressure on the distributors to handle Maine beers, and people are very loyal to their main beers. So you can find Brooklyn Lager if you really hunt up here. I have to admit, I'm mainly drinking a local beer made by Bissell Brothers in Portland, Maine. If you go to Paris or Tokyo or Stockholm, you'll find Brooklyn.
You told me when I first met you almost 20 years ago now that seeing someone either even just out in New York City, let alone around the world, ordering a Brooklyn Lager gave you a special feeling. Did that ever ebb, or was that always the case?
No, that's still the case. And you know, I do see the beer here every now and then, particularly down in Portland. It's still a big thrill. And I'm going to be going to Sweden in May because my daughter's on a Fulbright. That has taken her to the UK and Sweden, and we'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary of a brewery in Stockholm that we started and eventually sold to Carlsberg. So that'll be kind of a thrill.
A friend of mine who is a real beer aficionado, I was speaking to him this morning about Brooklyn Brewery. And he told me one of the great attributes is that it had the feeling when you had the beer of, and especially if you're outside of New York, that it was a taste of home.
Yes.
Is that an intangible, or is there something about that? Or is that just like muscle memory or sensory memory that gives people who are traveling around the country or around the globe? Is there something in there that, yeah, that's the taste of Brooklyn Brewery and that's the taste of home?
I think beer is kind of a magical experience, and your enjoyment of a beer has as much to do with where you are and when you're there than the actual beer. But people often associate a beer with a place in a way that is very special. And I think that's one of a little bit of the magic of beer.
So in the many, many, many people I've interviewed through the years in my career, I've been very fortunate. I believe you're the only one who was at the final game at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, New York. Now, first of all, not that I'm saying you were lying 17 years ago, but is this indeed still the case? That you were at the final game at Ebbets Field?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
You were how old at this point?
I was 8 years old.
And visiting New York from where?
From Middleport, Ohio, which is a tiny town on the Ohio River, not too far from Charleston, West Virginia. And I was in New York with my mother and grandmother for the Billy Graham Crusades, which was a very big deal for my mom and grandma.
At the Old Garden, I believe, right?
Yes, at the Old Garden up north of where it is now. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I assume first time in New York at that point, and you're 8 years old. You're old enough to be remembering things.
It was such a thrill being in New York. You know, I mean, eating a steak at like 11 o'clock at night. it was incredible.
When you're growing up, what's the atmosphere like in the town, in the home? And were there thoughts of, now you'd been to New York as an 8-year-old, but were there thoughts of, hey, there's a big world out there. I'm going to go see that world.
Well, you know, something happened to me when I was 13 years old. I was a carrier for the Athens, Ohio Messenger, a newspaper. I had a paper route, a big paper route, actually. And there was a contest sponsored by Family Weekly magazine. In fact, I don't know if you remember Family Weekly, but they were, you know, the Sunday magazine for hundreds of newspapers across America. So they did a contest for the most popular newsboy in Ohio. And they did one for each state because they had business all over the US. And I won that contest by selling subscriptions to the Athens Messenger. And as I recall, some kind of life insurance that cost like 5 cents a week or something. And I won a 2-week trip to Brazil.
Wow.
It was incredible. And this was the year, 1962, the year that Brasilia opened up. And we were in Rio and Brasilia and Sao Paulo and Porto Alegre. I was with 9 other winners from different states. All of them were much older than I. They were like 15, 16-year-olds. I was the youngest. But it was just an amazing trip. And you know, that, together with my experience in New York, really opened the world to me. I knew that I wanted to travel. I wanted to see things. I wanted to see the world.
So when you go off to Cornell, is there a notion of, all right, here's what I want to do, and I've got it locked in, or is it more undecided than that?
I had it locked in when I went to Cornell. I wanted to design golf courses. I was also a good junior golfer. I won some high school tournaments in upstate New York. We moved to upstate New York when I was 16. So, you know, Cornell is the alma mater of Robert Trent Jones, one of the most famous golf course designers. And so that was my intention when I went to Cornell, to design golf courses. So I was in the landscape architecture program, but I really, really wanted to read books. I did read a lot of books, and I couldn't believe I was at this amazing university and I wasn't taking, heavy English courses. So actually at the end of the first year, I played number one on the golf team, a couple of times and sometimes number two or three. And I had a 2 handicap in golf. I don't know if you know anything about golf, but my GPA was 1.9. That is not a good correlation.
No.
You're out of Cornell if your GPA is below 2.
And I would assume that correlation didn't go over well at home either.
Actually, my dad would have preferred that I had gone to Florida State
to become a
pro golfer. So when I told him I was quitting the golf team and I was going to try to switch into English, he was crushed. I mean, he thought, oh boy, I knew I should let him go to Cornell in the first place. But I ended up majoring in English. And, you know, that was something that I really wanted to do.
And your first job out of school was at a newspaper in upstate New York, yes?
Yeah, in the town where I had gone to high school, Seneca Falls, the birthplace of women's rights. I worked for the Seneca Falls Waterloo Reveille, and Howard Van Kirk was the editor. And I when I went into the office, I told him, I'm in a master's program at Cornell in English, and I want to write, and can I write for you? And he said, well, I can't pay you. And I said, no, that's okay. Just whatever. And he said, okay, can you interview the school board candidates by Thursday? And I said, yes. So he gave me a list of candidates. I traveled all around the county interviewing people, doing little profiles of them, taking a picture. And it was on the front page of the newspaper the next week. And he forgot my byline. Isn't that typical?
Yeah. How not to get young people interested in journalism by forgetting their byline.
Exactly. Yeah. But I did. I wrote for him for a couple of weeks, and then I got an offer from the Geneva, New York Times, which is now called the Finger Lakes Times. Right. And I worked there for like a year and a half before I came down to New York and eventually got the job with AP after working for some suburban newspapers around New York.
And how long were you at AP before they moved you to the Middle East?
Not long. I was in Newark for AP for like a year. And I heard that the guy who was in Beirut, George Krimsky, wanted out because he was a Russia expert, and he had been kicked out of Russia, accused of being a spy. And AP, in typical style, sent him to Beirut, which was not, you know, where he wanted to be. So he had been there like a year and a half, and he couldn't wait to get out. I heard about this through the bureau chief in Newark, who was an old Middle East hand himself. And so I started angling to get this job in Beirut. I started studying Arabic at the New School and let it be known I wanted to go to Beirut. And it was pretty clear there weren't too many guys who wanted to go to Beirut.
What year are we talking about here?
That would have been, I went to Beirut in February 1979.
Okay.
The same month that Ayatollah Khomeini came back to Iran, and the Shah went down.
So you go to the Middle East in 1979. Is this a slam dunk for you? This is going to be a great professional opportunity, or is there any pondering, shall we say, at night about A, should I do this? B, am I up to this? And are there any people who love you, family or otherwise, who were saying to you, wait a minute, are you really going to the Middle East?
Well, my dad was the first one to say, what the hell are you going there for? We don't have anything to do with those people, you know, because my grandfather, my father's father, had immigrated from Syria in 1894 when he was 12 years old. And so my dad really thought it was crazy, you know, and a lot of people thought it was crazy, but I felt it was an incredible opportunity as a journalist to cover, you know, something that really mattered to the world. And I was thrilled to be there. I was overwhelmed by the responsibility of it. I was right in the middle of very big stories shortly after I got there. Not too long after I got there, I was sent to Iran during the hostage story. And I was there for a couple of months before I got expelled from Iran. And then the year after that, I went to Iraq when the Iraqis invaded Iran, and I covered that war from the Iraqi side, and it was just a whirlwind of stories.
In 1979, you go to the Middle East, and almost immediately, you're, as you say, you're going to Iran at a time when the world is focused on Iran. I had a professor in college who once told me before I was heading off to a semester in Moscow, don't tell me about your grand theories, the macro stuff. Tell me about what you did. Tell me the stories, and we'll figure out how you felt about the rest of it. Is there a moment, a personal moment, or a moment in which you're covering something for you that stands out about that experience in Iran in 1979?
The amazing thing about it was the people were protesting every day and shouting death to America and death to the president. But they couldn't have been nicer to me. I was very impressed by the Iranians I met there. It just seemed to me they had been through a terrible time under the Shah, with dissent being, you know, virtually shut off. And then there was this possibility of a revolution and a big change. And a lot of people, I think, really believed that things were going to be better. But it wasn't long before, you know, the mullahs who took over kind of made it clear that they were basically stepping into the shoes that the Shah had left a few years before. And it wasn't called SAVAK anymore, the secret police, but it was equally as evil. And it amazes me that countries like Iran, with so many talented, bright, creative people, can end up in these horrible authoritarian nightmares of a country.
A couple of years later, you are in the vicinity, right there, near Anwar Sadat, when Sadat was assassinated. Even for someone covering the Middle East, is there any way to prepare for a moment like that?
You know, I was nervous whenever I was near anyone famous. You know, I spent not a lot of time, but some time in the presence of Yasser Arafat. And every moment I was there, I was waiting for a missile to come through the roof of wherever we were. And, you know, the same being around Iraqi leaders and, you know, being in Syria around officials, you're always waiting for something crazy to happen. So when I got to Egypt, I had just gotten my presidential security card a few days before that parade. And so the AP wasn't even going to send a reporter to cover the parade. They were just, actually, they did send a photographer. They figured to be a photo op with Sadat on the reviewing stand. But I went on my own because I wanted to see Sadat. I just got my security card. So I went to that parade, and I was sitting next to the New York Times reporter and Washington Post reporter. And, you know, it went on for about an hour, and it was kind of boring. I mean, there was part of it was kind of fun when the Camel Corps went by, but it was all these troops and different, you know, units of the Egyptian military. And then there were French Mirage jets just coming over the grandstand, and there were artillery pieces going by in front of the grandstand. And that's when the jeeps stopped, and the guys jumped out and charged the stage with their AK-47s and killed Sadat. I later learned immediately. I mean, they basically blew his head off. Mm-hmm. And there were about 11 other people killed. And we, you know, we kind of fought our way down to the site of where he had been shot. And the Egyptian police were like beating the guys, the killers. They had captured them. It was a chaotic scene. Sadat was nowhere to be seen. They had pulled him out immediately. And it was hours before they admitted that he was dead. But it was a very crazy, you know, unbelievable experience. I wrote a first person piece, which I was happy to see on the front page of the Daily News in New York a few days after. Yeah, that was the biggest story I covered.
Did that play a role at all? I know the decision to leave journalism and come back home happened, if I remember correctly, a couple of years later, but did the Sadat experience play a role in that at all?
No. I was very committed to journalism at that point, and AP wanted me to go to the Philippines because President Marcos was in trouble and I had a reputation for, you know, handling difficult stories. And I was excited about that. But my wife, Ellen, we had our first child in Beirut, second child in Cairo. So I told Ellen that AP wants me to go to the Philippines. And she said, I do not want to go. I'm not taking these babies to the Philippines. I've had enough of this. If you get transferred to Rome, I'm with you. You know, Paris, yes. The Philippines, Manila, never. And so I didn't want to go to Rome or Paris or London. I'd rather be in New York than be in those places. So, you know, I really reluctantly gave it up and came back to New York and went to work for Newsday for like a year and a half and started making beer at home based on meeting these American diplomats in Cairo who were homebrewers. They had been posted in Saudi Arabia where there's no alcoholic beverages, or at least there wasn't back then. And they were avid homebrewers. So I started homebrewing when I came back to New York. And that was the seeds of the Brooklyn Brewery.
The decision to go, okay, I'm going to be leaving journalism and I'm going to start a brewery. did you get a similar reception in terms of the people who love you, what they thought, as you did when you were heading off to the Middle East?
My dad was thrilled.
Oh.
He said, finally, you make some money with that Cornell degree. And actually, he was my first investor. This is a guy who wouldn't even lend us money when we were trying to buy an apartment in New York City. But he was the first one to come up with $20,000 to support the Brooklyn Brewery venture, which of course worked out well for all involved.
But took some time.
Oh, took a lot of time, yeah.
And so in those early years, are there nights of, you know, what did I do? Or is it, hey, I have a passion for this thing. I had a passion for journalism. We're going to see this through. We're going to make this go.
The latter. I was committed to it. I knew I could make it work. But it was very difficult. Actually, in 1991, the brewery really could not afford to pay me and my partner, Tom. So I went back to work for Newsday in the first Gulf War. And I went to Newsday at from the 4 p.m. to midnight shift, editing the copy for the first Gulf War. Then in the morning, I would get up and call my customers to get orders for beer before driving out to Melville, to Newsday newsroom. It was a very difficult year. I was burning it, the candle at both ends, but I was still committed to the brewery. And so after a year, the company kind of, we kind of righted ourselves, righted the company financially, and I was able to go back full time. And actually, Newsday won a Pulitzer Prize that year, which with a really good reporter named Pat Sloyan, whose story called The Highway of Death, about how the Americans basically mowed down the Iraqis as they fled Kuwait. It was an infamous sort of story.
That part of your story, being a correspondent, Associated Press correspondent in the Middle East, and then transitioning into being a brewer in Brooklyn, and then a very well-known brewer, has gotten a lot of attention, rightfully so. From what you know of other people in the brewery business, the notion of it, that being an unconventional path to brewing, is that indeed the case? Or do you find people have come from all sorts of different beginnings to get involved in brewing?
Oh, they came from every, you know, the founder of Sierra Nevada, you know, one of the most successful craft breweries. Ken Grossman ran a bicycle repair shop before he he's an incredible engineer, and you know, he was always tinkering, building his own breweries. And you know, there were school teachers who got into it. Of course, there were banker types who got into it. Jim Cook from Sam Adams was a banker. You know, he's a Harvard MBA and JD, brilliant guy, and hardest working guy in the beer business. So there were people from all different walks of life who got into beer, but I think my story was the most interesting.
If you do say so yourself. I remember once you told me that I think the first brewery was in Bushwick.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And at a time now, Bushwick is like an art, street art, haven, and people come from all over the world to see the street art. Not so much the case in the late 80s, and that the truckers wouldn't even get out of the truck when they were delivering for fear of crime. True?
They refused to come to Brooklyn after dark. You know, they if they were coming into New York, they would park in New Jersey overnight and come at like 8 a.m, and they wanted to get in and get out. Yeah, these big burly truck drivers, and you know, here we are, a bunch of skinny home brewers who were roughing it in this very high crime neighborhood of Bushwick.
And you were the ones unloading the trucks, yes?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Under the heading of what's wrong with this picture? So when did it come about that you were able to, with those original investors, finally handed them checks?
2003. So that's 15 years after we started. 2003, I had all our original investors at the brewery, and we gave them checks for the amount they had invested. So if they invested $20,000, they got $20,000 back, and they kept their stock. So it was you know, they did very well, because there were distributions after that as we, you know, made money. So people got paydays pretty nicely with the Brooklyn Brewery investment.
And the Brooklyn Brewery name and the logo, thanks to the late, great Milton Glaser,
yes,
now a blessed memory, became known around New York, around the country, around the world. But in those lean years, and there were more than a few of them, what keeps you going? Is there something in particular you can point to, or a lesson you learned at home or early on, or maybe as a correspondent, that got you through some of those difficult times?
You know, I feel like I put myself in challenging situations before. You know, when I was 12 years old and selling those newspaper subscriptions, you know, some days when I was out knocking on doors, and I hadn't made any sale, I would keep going until I made a sale. And, you know, I learned that the way you win a sales contest is to get out there and sell, you know. And so it was the same when I was out selling beer in New York. You know, I didn't take no for an answer, and I just kept going back. And early on, you know, we estimated it took like 7 sales calls to open an account, to gain the trust of the customer, and to sell them beer. So I think it was that kind of dogged, repetitive sort of commitment to getting it done. And, you know, I feel the same way about writing. You know, and Milton always used to tell me, if you want to be a writer, you have to write. So you have to pick an hour of the day where you're going to do nothing but write. And even if you just sit there sometimes and stare at the wall, that hour is your writing hour. And that's the way you're going to get something done. And so, you know, it was the same with selling those newspaper subscriptions, and the same as selling investors on investing in the Brooklyn Brewery and selling beer.
Selling beer and now having it sold all over the world.
And that's a big thrill. That is amazing to think that, you know, I can go virtually anywhere in the world and have a Brooklyn beer. And here in Maine too, but I just have to search a little hard here.
Maybe put a cover over it also.
Yeah.
Steve Hindy, he's gotten back to writing, both commentaries for some local papers in Maine, and he's working on an historical novel about his grandfather, who emigrated to the U.S. by himself as a 12-year-old in 1894 from Syria. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions and Gemini 13 Productions. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well. No extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.